Are you looking for a Columbus car dealership built on tradition and trust? Buyers Auto, family-owned since 1897, offers top new and pre-owned vehicles. Visit us or shop online at buyersauto.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
Dr. Jordan Wiggins is a naturopathic doctor, an author, and pleasure and intimacy coach who is revolutionizing conversations around women's sexual health and wellness. She's the CEO of The Pleasure Collective, a coaching community dedicated to helping high-achieving women reclaim their pleasure, and the host of the amazing Pleasure Principles podcast, which I highly recommend. I'll listen to this first, then go and look up that podcast. where sex, science, and sensuality meet. With over 13 years of medical and holistic experience, Dr. Wiggins combines her professional expertise with personal experience as a sexual abuse survivor and women's wellness advocate. She's the author of The Pink Canary, The Hidden Secret to Optimum Health for Women, and retired owner of a seven-figure women's health clinic. Dr. Wiggins is on an amazing mission to reverse the statistic that one in two women globally suffer from sexual dysfunction. She helps successful women achieve as much fulfillment in their relationships and lives as they do in their careers through learning to receive, trust, and attract. Her philosophy centers on the belief that great sex is just the beginning. Everything improves when women learn how to receive better sex, better health, and more wealth. Wow, there's a lot there.
And, I know. And,
you know, you're probably not hoping this is going to take 8 hours to go through, but it could easily. So I'll dive into some questions if that's okay, and we'll see what we can uncover.
Let's do it.
I did just want to start by taking you back a little bit to your formative years, and I wondered if you could share what early experiences you think shaped the path to where you are today, and I guess ultimately whether a 14-year-old Jordan would recognize who you are today.
I love that question. And 2 days ago, one of my clients, we did our pre-med degrees together. I sort of took a less conventional path, and she practices family medicine. Mm-hmm. And she sent me my application to med school, like questions from it. And she's like, look, you knew you had super traits back then. And anyways, it was a fascinating sort of reflection of the past to now, and how I sort of always knew who I was. But younger years, I grew up in a home where success was rewarded. Really no talk of emotions or feelings, and I felt loved if I didn't need anything and I was doing well, getting good grades, doing, you know, achieving at sports. So that sort of became my identity and the way to get love, or that's how I interpreted it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you're good at sports, you're good academically, and then you start achieving that way and get recognition that way. So that just became part of my identity. And I had hormone issues. There's really sort of two pivotal parts to this, the hormone issues and then the sex issues and how those converge into what I do today. So when I started having hormone issues on birth control, just standard things didn't work for me. And that's why after my pre-med degree, I went into naturopathic medicine and functional medicine, thinking that if I can just help women with their hormones, you know, they'll help their mood, their energy, their overthinking. It's going to fix everything. And that's where I started in my career, and with a women's health clinic, helping women with their hormones. And I still do that to this day. I think it's very important, and women are drastically underserved with hormone replacement therapy, and that significantly impacts sexual health. So I'm not discrediting that at all. But then there was this whole second phase of my career, and that was where I was prescribing the hormones. Everything was looking great on labs, you know, physically things were good. Women were sleeping. They didn't have vaginal dryness anymore. Just, you know, we're doing my introduction and we're talking about vaginal dryness, but things were good sort of like mechanically, and we were checking all those medical boxes, but they were saying, you know, I just don't feel like myself. I'm not as happy as I was or as I should be. I don't feel connected to my partner and people in my life. Some of them didn't care if they ever had sex ever again. They wanted to want it because their partner wanted them to want it. But it was, they'd lost this spark in their sense of self. And then that's when I wrote The Pink Canary. It was kind of like that journey to finding pleasure again.
And do you attribute the change in hormones that women go through to have a direct impact on their desire for a sex life? Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And this is a very interesting and nuanced question. It's a yes and. Okay. So I worked with many people and like thousands of women, that it was that perimenopausal time.
Yeah.
It used to be early 40s. Now it's kind of even late 30s. I'm sort of seeing it younger and younger, which in and of itself is a massive problem. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, they weren't sleeping. Their mood was all over the place. They wanted to murder their partners the week before their period. And they were coming to me for help because they're, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm snapping at things that I shouldn't be. And they thought that hormones would be the fix to everything. You know, just give me a little vaginal estrogen, mm-hmm. some testosterone or progesterone, and we're on our way. It's going to fix everything. And that's sort of even what I went into my career thinking, that if I could do adequate hormone prescribing and testing, that it was going to make a massive difference. And it does, but it is not this silver bullet cure all that they wanted it to be. So many things improved. Their sleep improved, maybe their tolerance improved. They weren't having those physical symptoms, but that spark, that connection, that just, you know, singing in the shower or dancing in the kitchen, just feeling alive, feeling happy, that didn't come back. And that was this whole other phase of my career. And in my career sort of walked parallel to my personal life, because it started with the hormone issues, with birth control. I had a surgery on my vagina from a cyst, which is actually, it's a common surgery, but because we have so much shame about women's health, especially any gynecological concerns, we don't talk about it. But 25% of women have had this surgery, and it's like an episiotomy. But I was in my late teens when I had it. So that I had pain with sex, and it just sort of sent me on this journey of, you know, well, why does sex hurt? And no one had any answers for me. And they're not going to tell, you know, a 17-year-old, well, just have a glass of wine, but it's not useful any advice anyway, no matter what age you are. So, but I felt shame, like what was wrong with me, and my friends were, you know, like sexually active, no problems with birth control, no, you know, no pain with sex, that kind of thing. So, and then how those issues translated into my marriage. And it was really two things. It was this, I was very focused on my career and all those high achieving traits, which now I know they have a name. Sandra Brown did research on super traits, and they are skills that we have learned to survive. And that's all of my clients have these. I have a free quiz that I developed. I can send the link for the listeners that are wondering, do I have these? But it's basically, we have over empathy. So we're very, very empathetic to the point that, you know, we lose ourselves because we care so much about another person. We're extremely hardworking. Again, great for career success and things like that, but difficult in relationships. So I had this amazing career. People were flying to see me at my medical clinic. I was maybe 31, 32. Like the career was insanely impressive, but I would come home and I'd have nothing left in the tank. No time for friendships, no time for my husband. And so these super traits make you really successful at a lot of areas in your life. But when it comes to intimacy, connection, sex, it's kind of, they're sort of the opposite of what we need.
It's really interesting. And to go back to one of the early answers you gave about in your childhood, your teenage years, you were rewarded for success, whether it be academic or sporting or whatever the different thing would be. And I think that's one of the challenges we face as a society, without going very broad with this discussion, is how we define success. So you'd obviously been taught, and it had been embedded in you, that success was coming top of the class, getting an A, or doing well in your GPAs, or doing well in your sporting event, whatever. So it's very natural then to think, well, one of the things I do as a young adult or as a young woman is I have sexual relationships. So therefore, I must be successful in those. I must be a success.
And when exactly.
And when you had your issues with your surgery and with discomfort, whatever, you suddenly feel, gosh, I'm not a success. So therefore, if you're not a success, what are you? Failure? Obviously, you're not a failure. But that's the challenge. It's we either succeed or we don't. It's not, there's not that degree. And I think that's such a difficult place for people to be in. My daughter's 18 and my son's 16. And my daughter's just started university last semester. And my son as well. And they sort of say, oh gosh, what will we do for careers? What will our jobs be? And I said, well, it is very easy as a parent to say, but we would so much rather you be happy and you decide what success feels like for yourselves, rather than judge it by your salary, how many hours a week you work. This sounds terrible. My first sign of success at work was when I first got my name on my office door. I'm a success. And then when I'd be in 50 meetings a week, I'm a success because I'm in all these meetings. Ridiculous. But then I'd come home, as you say, I'd come home and I'm no time for my wife, no time for the children, no time to go to the gym, nothing at all. But I was successful at work. And that's a challenge. So how do you help people pivot from, yes, wanting to succeed, because that's a good thing, but in the field and the way you choose, and in almost realigning the super traits that all women have to be more focused on other elements of their life apart from work and career? Gosh, that's a big question.
It's macro and it's micro. So I started working what you think is with couples and their sexual relationship, or, you know, I was working on the women's side of that equation, but their goal was, you know, I want to have better sex. I want to be connected in my personal life or have a personal life. And when you're wired with these high achieving, these super traits, the pleasure centers in your brain are turned off. And that's actually studied. And we can think about it logically, right? Yeah. If we are stressed out or, you know, we're running off cortisol every day because we have all these meetings, then our body is prioritizing survival, not reproduction. So some of it at the beginning is just, it's just a re-education of, first of all, there's nothing wrong with you. This is how your body is supposed to function.
Yeah.
And when they can understand their super traits, because, so say there's something wrong, and let's just say sexually, that their partner's having erectile dysfunction or they don't want sex themselves. Somebody with super traits, their natural way to approach fixing that is to research and listen to podcasts and read, and they're like, they're doing more, and doing more in career and society generally gets you success. It gets you the outcome that you want. So it's this unlearning of, oh, okay, well, if I want to want sex, first of all, I need the pleasure centers in my brain on. I need to be in a receptive state, because if the pleasure centers are off, then touch isn't as pleasurable, orgasms aren't going to feel as good. And we know that we want sex that's good for us. The sex that we're trying to, you know, tick the boxes, you're going to stop wanting that eventually. So just by teaching women, or just by having that awareness of these super traits do not work in sex and in relationship. And it's not just sexual relationships, it's all relationships, relationships with our children, friendships, and, you know, even work relationships. If we're constantly overgiving, we're constantly fixing, maybe even micromanaging, it never ends well. So just that general understanding of the concept is a massive relief for most people, because they can sort of go, oh, okay, like I at least get the problem now. Because what they're trying to do is learn communication tips or go to therapy, which doesn't even often work for women with super traits, sex therapy, couples therapy, because it results in them doing more and worsening the dynamic that already exists. So unless the therapist sees that, which is rare, usually less than 10% of the time. So there's this massive shame of, you know, something's wrong with me. Maybe this just has to be the way it is, or maybe I'm just broken. Maybe I'm asexual. Maybe, you know, maybe I need to leave my marriage, but that's not even it necessarily. We need to learn how to relate to people when we're not in that high achieving survival mode. And that's so scary for women with super traits to do. And I know, because I walked that path myself, and the thought of, you know, letting go, surrendering, receiving, I didn't even know the concept of receiving wasn't even in my awareness or worldview at that point. Because I thought that my worth was tied to, you know, how good of a doctor I was, how good of a wife I was, how good, you know, and good is in air quotes, I was at sex. And by trying to be good at sex, you know, usually your partner is very pleased, but then, you know, you stop wanting it because you're not in the equation, or you don't know what you want and what feels good for you.
Gosh, so much to ask and say about that. And I think what one of the two things, I guess. What one is, I guess there's a distinction between women that come to you or women that perhaps haven't reached out to you yet, who decide they want to have better sex because that's what they think their partner wants, so they're doing it for somebody else, versus wanting to have better sex themselves. And that could be a great self-pleasure practice, it could be with somebody else, could be whatever. And then I think the second thing is, one of the big challenges I've always thought about sex is that it's very performative and goal-oriented. The goal is orgasm, to get off. That's the goal, at least.
Yeah, and hopefully at the same time, like the movies.
Well, I hope so. That's our target. And if we almost if we just replace the word sex in our heads with pleasure and got away from thinking that sex in heteronormative relationships is penis and vagina, that's sex. If you haven't done that, you've not had sex. And think about actually how intimate it can be just to look at somebody, to brush somebody's hair, to massage somebody, to hold their hand. All those things can be incredibly pleasurable. But as mid-50s now, my erections aren't the same as they were when I was 18, for goodness sake. So I can't always perform in the way that I might want to. But does that mean I can't be intimate with my partner? Maybe it does, but I think, and maybe a lot of people think it does. I can't have sex, therefore we haven't got, people talk about not having a sex life. And what they're basically saying is they're not having penetrative sex.
Yeah, penis and vagina,
But there's so much more to it. Is that part of the discussion you have, almost expanding people's concept of what intimacy, sex and pleasure is all about?
That was the pink canary. My book that I wrote in 2019 was on that topic, that we need to expand our view of pleasure and have more pleasure in all aspects of life.
Yeah.
From, you know, throwing out the clothes in your closet that don't feel good on you, or enjoying how the sun feels on your skin. But all of those things, whether they're in or out of the bedroom, require presence. And we can't be present when we are in survival mode and our super traits are taking over. So that is a massive part of what I teach, is expanding the definition of pleasure, and then how do we receive it? Right? Because if our pleasure centers are off, we're sort of repellent to it all. We're going through the motions, you know. We probably showered and had a coffee and didn't smell our shampoo and didn't taste our coffee and didn't take time to enjoy putting on moisturizer. We're just sort of slapping it on and going through the motions because we're in a rush. So, and in part of that, and part of the point of the pink canary, is that we're taught work hard first and pleasure after. And that's one of the big fundamental flaws, I think. If we can put pleasure first in and out of the bedroom, then all the other things kind of fall into place and we're healthier that way. And I'm not talking like I am still a high achiever. I will always have super traits. It's part of who I am, right? I'm not going to be happy out in wildflower fields picking, you know, flowers all day. That's not going to be enough for me. But changing our outlook to where pleasure is the most important thing, and teaching people to make decisions from that worldview. You know, I have clients that it's, you know, should I buy this other company? Should I expand my portfolio? Should I take this other role? And a lot of them are those outward metrics of success. One of the filters that I have people ask themselves is, you know, will it bring me more pleasure, more joy, more orgasms to do this? Or is it going to be more stress, more headache, more survival? And because I started this journey working with people and their health, it was women with autoimmune diseases, breast cancer survivors, women that had had cardiovascular events at a young age. And if we sort of reverse that whole thing, it was because, and you know, not, I'm not completely saying cause and effect, but they were living life in that stress response, taking those boxes, doing what they thought they should, and had no ability to look inward, listen to their body to see how they were feeling. You know, did they need to rest? Did they need to walk in the sun? Did they need to, you know, stop for a meal or a bathroom break? They were just, you know, plowing through their lives, giving to others and not listening to themselves. So to see where it ends, you know, medically, when we're really stressed and we're not caring for ourselves, it prioritizing pleasure is something that we should do for our health.
It's very interesting you said that. I talked to actually maybe two or three people now, the people that have women that have suffered from terrible forms of cancer, and also some that suffered really, really challenging heart disease. And one of the big challenges they felt, and we were talking about intimacy in relationships, and they said that, and quite naturally in a way, I guess, the medical profession's focus is very much on fixing or curing the illness or the disease, getting rid of the cancer, curing the heart disease, whatever. And they said they sort of left, and yes, they were to all intents and purposes cured or in remission or whatever the right word is. But they said that they had no idea how to re-engage with their partner, to understand what, were they allowed to be intimate again? Were they allowed to have pleasure from touch and hold and feel, whatever? That wasn't part of the medical diagnosis. And I understand that medical professionals are incredibly busy and they are focused on curing something which can kill you, which has obviously got a bit of priority. But they said, yeah, coming out the other side of it, almost it was like, well, there you go. You're better now. And they were sort of thinking, well, I'm not sure I am. Yes, physically I don't have this thing anymore, but that's one of the challenges.
There's a massive gap in. And then they have their follow-up scans and blood work and that's sort of it. But there's nothing to deal with the psychological component of what they'd been through, stress-wise, or the impacts that has had on them physically.
Yeah.
And even discussion, and I come at it mostly from the women's health angle, and things are changing. They're updating, thank goodness. But a lot of these cancers, it's like, if, you know, you get a mastectomy and like that's a massive part of your identity.
Yeah.
And then about engaging sexually after that, there's zero conversation or education in the conventional medical system about that. So, or surgeries where, you know, your ovaries are removed, or you're given a drug that puts you into menopause immediately. And it's just sort of like this is the way it is now. But they are changing that because they know that the genitourinary symptoms, and like a lot of those women never wanted to have sex because it was so painful after. And it's just sort of, oh, here's lube, you know. It's so on the patient side of things, that was, well, the breast cancer survivors was a big part of why I got into, because they were seeking alternative care and seeking somebody that did have the time to sit with them and discuss all of those things that their oncologists and surgeons did not. And helping to find them answers. But in a lot of it, like stress, which turns the pleasure centers off, lack of safety, based on the trauma of a diagnosis and treatment like that, and not lack of safety of not knowing, kind of being left to their own devices. That's a recipe to turn off desire and arousal just from the way that they're treated in the system.
I mean, it's a terrible admission to make, but I think if men had periods every month and gave birth and had the menopause and suffered from breast cancer, etc., I kind of think it'd be a bit different. And I guess my hope is, and this is not going to be a diatribe against the sort of patriarchy, but that's for another podcast. But my sort of hope is, I guess, as more and more women go into medicine and become more and more knowledgeable, hopefully this will start to change. But then the challenge is, I guess, that they typically at the moment are still being taught by men, and I've been taught a lot of medicine was developed for the average, you know, 180 pounds man, and lots of
created by men for men.
I know seatbelts in cars were designed for men. They weren't designed for people with breasts. I mean, it's so many things that were designed for, weren't designed for an average, they were designed for men to fix. And it's only now that, gosh, we've got this whole other area. And I think there's so much in the UK, it's changing slightly around the menopause in particular. There's more discussion, but still in general, if you're a woman and go to the doctor and say, I'm going through perimenopause, like menopause, or somebody, okay, you can go on HRT or don't go on HRT. Here's the HRT we have available. That's sort of it. And it, and I'm talking, I mean, my wife won't mind me saying this, she's going through menopause now, and it's the lack of information is scary in a way, but then that leaves you in a more, almost a more dangerous situation where you're left to your own devices to do your research. And we all know the internet's an amazing place, but also a place of myths and mistruths and misleading elements. So it's very hard to know where to go to actually know what to do. Because you talk to your friends, you talk to your girlfriends, and they say, well, I'm on HRT, it's amazing. I'm on HRT, it's terrible. I'm not on HRT, it's amazing. I'm not on HRT, it's terrible. It's so hard to know where to go and what to do, unless they find themselves fortunate enough to come across somebody like you. It's hard, isn't it?
Women have, yes, definitely been left out of healthcare, medical research, even through education systems. Still medical education is developed by men for men. And like you said, it's changing slowly, even in North America. Mm-hmm. At least there's, you know, women have to be included in medical research now, but dosing for medication, that kind of thing. And it was the Women's Health Initiative in 2002 that really, really messed a lot of people, generations, really, like the boomers got screwed from that, because everyone was scared to take hormone. And then they have, you know, such vaginal dryness and pain with sex that they don't want to have it. They're like urinary leakage and stuff, all that. But vaginal estrogen is very, very safe. But then there's this whole, you know, generation of women that didn't get that. And that it has a massive ripple effect on them, their marriages. So we do need a whole other podcast for that, but it's fascinating to me how much women in women's pleasure especially is it's left to your own devices or figure it out yourself. When, you know, it's very easy to get testosterone or Viagra. Men do not have the same barriers to care that women do. And I mean, sadly, I think that's a global, it's a global issue.
So do you, it feels like you may have already answered this in part, but do you believe there is a direct connection between a woman's ability to receive in the bedroom and her ability and openness to receiving other areas of her life? And the reason I ask that is that a lot of research will show that if there's a job advert on LinkedIn and it says you need to have these 10 skills, if a man's got two of them, he'll apply. If a woman's got, if she's got nine of them, she's, oh, I haven't got the 10th, I'm not sure what's for me. There's this almost reluctance to push forward to receive. So do you find there's a correlation between receiving in the bedroom in the broadest context and then receiving in other areas of life?
Absolutely. I feel like it's all connected. And women with super traits, that we have this inherent belief that I'm only worthy to receive if I've earned it, if I've sacrificed, if I've worked really hard, then it's okay. Right. So in our careers, it's great because we've worked hard. We have, you know, the degrees or the accolades to show that. So therefore it's okay. But we would have, you know, 12 of the 10 qualifications to apply for that job. Right. Yeah. So yes. And same with love, but then it can make it hard even for a well-intentioned partner to give or love, love us when, you know, they're trying, but maybe we're so stressed out, we're critical or, you know, something wasn't done the way that we thought it should be because we're controlling out of fear that we're in that survival state. And then I also see a lot of women with super traits. They're this over-functioner, but they're paired with an under-functioner, like an extreme under-functioner. Mm. So somebody with active addiction or a partner that doesn't work and plays video games all day, but also doesn't do any of the household chores or emotional labor of the relationship. So there's these massive imbalances and she just feels like she can't let it go. Cause if she stops, then who's going to pick up the slack? So really she's not receiving in any area. Cause she doesn't even think that there's a belief that she can. And that shift in myself that I'm only worthy of love if I'm giving, right? If I give something first, then I'm entitled to something in return. And whatever I gave had to be more than what I got back. But now, you know, if my neighbor plowed the driveway for me, these are Canadian problems. But anyways, for him and his truck, it just took like two swipes and it, but that made my day.
Yeah.
And I let it make my day. And then he felt good doing it. I felt good receiving the help, but I wasn't, well, and I will admit for a second, I'm like, okay, you know, what does he drink or what can I bake something and, you know, like there was that. Mm-hmm. I need to repay this. And then I can sort of stop and go, okay, wait, you know, I'm allowed to have something good done for me just because, not because I earned it. And we need that, you know, support in all areas or support at work, support at home, even money, like to receive money when you didn't, because my clients, when they leave a role at work, they're usually replaced by two people. They need to hire two people in their place. They weren't getting paid double for their workload, right? Yeah. So receiving your value monetarily as well, it's all the same, in my opinion. It's tolerating sensation. If we're going on like the micro level, good, pleasurable sensation, and the other side of that coin is pain, but the ability to be present with high sensation. And that's tantra, really. So it's all connected, in my opinion.
I find myself agreeing very much. But one of the, and this is definitely not a reason not to make the change, but it feels that a lot of the women you see will find themselves almost making a seismic change emotionally. About you suddenly discover pleasure in a different way. You discover that you are of value, that you are worthy of receiving pleasure, whether that be at work or at home or whatever else. What happens to the power dynamics between the couple, assuming there's a couple? Because obviously I'm assuming the husband, and not as extreme as staying at home over video games all day long. The husband is busy working, is just playing a very traditional male role. And then suddenly his partner is in recognition that they are worth and deserving of more, not in a selfish way, just in a balanced way. What happens to the dynamic in the relationship? How can the partner come along on the journey? I guess at some points they don't come along. They decide to sort of check out, which, you know, is better than staying where you were. But how does that?
I love this part. I love this emotionally messy.
It is part. Very messy, isn't it? Yeah,
I do. I love it, and sometimes it is brought on by, you know, perimenopause or something. Yeah. And so many women, like they're coming to me either on the hormone side or the pleasure side, and it's, you know, fix me so I don't feel, or fix me so this isn't as messy. And it's like this clamped fire hose, like they've tried not to feel their whole lives, right? And then when we unclamp it, it's gonna get a little messy, but the flow will eventually even out. And sometimes we need that hormone replacement therapy to help us. But that menopause or perimenopause, in my opinion, is a gift, right? Where it's meant to, we should pause and reevaluate. Mm-hmm. So I think that it gets a whole lot more fun when a woman is in touch with her desire. And I think sometimes there's this initial, I don't know if I want to call it like a tantrum, or a little, like for somebody that that's had their needs met and hasn't really needed to focus on somebody else's needs at all, there might be an initial little turbulence. But then generally when the woman is like sovereign and in her erotic power, which is, that's this like receiver, that's where I help women go, eventually their partner's like, get me on that ride. Like, I want to go where she's going, you know? So, and I think we build it up in our heads that it's going to be a lot worse, especially when we're conditioned to serve and tolerate and give and not put ourselves on the map. But it's amazing. And I feel like whole family systems can heal when, you know, when the mom or wife has been a shell of herself because she's cooking the meals that everyone else wants and doing everything for everybody to make sure they're good. when she gets that light back, that spark back, it's magnetic and everyone wants to see her, see her that way, and not the crusty, snippy, resentful version of herself when she's is achieving and not receiving. So once we can kind of get through those emotional turbulence times, then it's so much better. And that's like, I call that a pleasure-centered relationship or a pleasure-centered family system. And that's where everyone's joy and fulfillment matters, because that's sustainable. Yeah. A system where one person is overgiving and other people are taking, that's extractive. And it's going to cost that person their health and well-being and sanity. So it's not, and yeah, it's not sustainable. And I think my clients sustain it anyway, because they have super traits, right? They're so hardworking. They're so tolerant. They're so forgiving,
yeah.
But they're miserable. And then if people really love you, right, is that what they want for you? They definitely don't. So when we can drop the performance and truly say, like, I'm not happy, this isn't working, and then take that path to pleasure, it's so therapeutic for everyone involved.
It's one of the big challenges, isn't it? I think, and I always think, gosh, I always feel sorry for teenagers. They get puberty and then they have exams and looking for jobs, and it's just because puberty comes at the worst time. And it almost feels a similar thing with menopause in a way, because menopause typically comes around the same time that men perhaps have some form of erectile dysfunction. It also comes at the time, often, or certainly used to, I know ages are a bit different now, where a couple will suddenly find their children left home. And a couple that's been together for 20, 30 years look at each other and think, oh gosh, oh, it's the two of us. Okay, now what? And now what could be, oh my goodness, this is an amazing chance to, you know, have sex in every room in the house and run around naked or whatever. Or it can be, gosh, maybe we've been together for the kids. And I think it's not often for many people during a long-term relationship that we sit down and hold and create a safe space to have a conversation about all of those things. Because there's things that you might have done sexually, intimately, in the beginning of your relationship that you don't enjoy anymore. There's things that perhaps you might want to try that you've been thinking about for the last 5 years but don't know how to raise them. It's almost how do you create that space for that conversation? Because nobody wants to be mocked or laughed or to repulse their partner or whatever. But how do you have that conversation?
I have a lot of clients that come to me in that time when they're sort of newly empty nesters and there's a lot of change going on, and they've been in service of the family for so long that it's, you know, who are we as a couple? And, you know, but there's a lot of people that are in this sort of sandwich generation, and perimenopause is hitting early, and they're like, they have elderly parents that they're caring for. They have kids still at home, and that's a whole mess too, but it requires a lot of support. But those, I don't feel like we can have those conversations unless we truly know ourselves sexually, because then there's some blame, shame, you know, accusation, and none of that's fair to put on our partners.
Yeah.
So for my clients anyway, right, there's been service of others or focus on other people's pleasure and not our own. So there, the journey that I help women go on is what do I want? What do I desire? How do I like to be touched? And it should change throughout life, because everyone wants to get back to this, like, oh, well, when we first met, And yeah, sometimes when you first met, you were 20 and now you're empty nesters. Yeah. So it's definitely going to be different, and it should be. And that's also part of it. And why would you want the same sex that you were having when you're 20, when there's so much other things to explore and ways to connect? So I think you have to have a really good sense of self and your desires, which would require your pleasure centers to be on and you to be in a receiver archetype, not an achiever archetype. Because when you're an achiever and you try and have those conversations, then it's, you know, we have our CEO hat on and it sounds critical and like we're trying to check boxes and it doesn't feel intimate at all. And just telling the truth is also a massive first step that you could say, you know, I'm feeling lost here. I want to explore intimacy and know what that next chapter looks like, but I don't know where to start. Mm. Like just genuine authenticity is a great place to start, because then that's something that you can create together. And that's also like hopefully assuming that you have a willing partner, because when we get into that over-functioner, under-functioner dynamic, it can get a little sticky sometimes having those conversations.
Mm. A lot of people that come to you, they're generally at a point of transition or challenge, or things aren't perhaps going as well as they might hope. So they're not typically coming to you to tell you how wonderful everything is. So how do you protect and nourish your own mental well-being? Because you want to be present for the person at the time, but it doesn't do anybody any good if you're carrying their issues with you. So how do you look after yourself?
That's a great question, because of my high achieving tendencies, and I know I have that tendency to overgive, I significantly limit the number of private clients that I take or number of people that I allow in my groups, like just sheer time, because I need time to go for walks, to go to the gym, go to jujitsu, do things that make me, spend like, and if I'm not present for my family, then I know I'm doing it wrong. So time is one thing. I try to energetically close sessions at one. I worked with an energy healer at one point, and I used to have these dreams about my patients, and I literally dream about, like, I had these, they were sort of like iridescent, almost like umbilical cord representing like all my patients. And it was like I was taking care of them or checking on them in my dreams when I was really overfunctioning and my clinic was so busy. So she said, that's a problem. And this is a little woo even for me, but it seems to work, where I'm like disconnecting from the client, I'm closing my tabs on my browser, you know, washing my hands, washing my face, changing my clothes. Like I have these sort of rituals, and I teach my clients that as well. Because if you're, you know, sitting on a board or you're in an operating room, or, you know, I have a lot of accountants in there, they're in tax season. It's like, how do you not bring that home to your partner?
Yeah.
So we're kind of doing those same things to disconnect, so I can be different versions of me. If it's coach, if it's doctor, if it's mom, you know, I try to separate them energetically and with time.
And do you love yourself?
I do now. I didn't. I didn't for a lot of years. And it was actually healing from an abusive relationship that broke me in ways that I couldn't describe. And abuse had sort of been a part of my history, and I think a part of the gifts that I can give now. But leaving that and not knowing what food I liked to eat because I was told, or what music I liked to listen to, or, you know, I couldn't go out of the house because I would pay for it when I got home. And I want to also note that abuse isn't just verbal or physical sexual assault, right? There's a lot of covert forms of abuse that are not screened for. They're not, laws are changing. Actually, I think they did massive updates to the laws in the UK recently to include coercive control, which is amazing. Yeah, that's lovely. And that has so much to do with my work on the meta sort of bigger side of things, because a lot of women's desires shut down because they are being coercively controlled and they don't know how to name it. I was a successful doctor. I made my own money. No one was screening me that I was being abused and controlled and stalked and monitored. Because it doesn't even look like there's anything wrong on the outside. So anyways, long story short, healing from that, and thankfully I had my work at that time, in my sort of foundational program of pleasure principles, it was okay, what would I tell a client to do? Yeah. I'd tell her to put pleasure anchors in her day. Mm-hmm. And that started with, I would literally wash my face in the morning with my skincare routine that I loved, and in the evening, and I would take my supplements. And that's how broken I was, and that's how much I needed to rebuild myself, that those were wins for me at that time, that I could focus on doing that for me. But that process of, thinking that I knew who I was and being at the height of my career and my life, and, slowly being broken and then needing to rebuild myself again, then I learned to love myself and me for me, not me for what I could achieve or how much money I could make or how many people I could help. And I've asked my clients this that are high achievers all the time, if it all went away tomorrow, all the success, all the, who are you and what makes you happy? Hmm. So I can answer those now. And I know who I am outside of work and outside of my achievements. So yes, long-winded answer, but yes,
It was a good answer. And is that part, so on your website, there are some very beautiful photographs of you, some in lingerie, some in nightwear, one in a bath, on a bed, whatever. And it's part of that saying, here I am, I love myself, I know myself, and I understand who Jordan Wiggins is.
No, I built that house with my abuser, actually. And I'm looking at updating those photos. but that was a little bit in that coming out phase, right? I needed to know who I was again. But and that's the funny part. No one would look at that and say, she was being controlled or abused.
God, no, not at all.
And we look at these couples online and they look happy, and we really have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. So
And but that's one of the challenges with a lack of education about these things is young people. You don't know it's happening until it's gone so far. It's very hard to come back out of it, really. And I think that's one of the big challenges, that it's so insidious and so slow, and you're not sure yourself, is that really happening? Is that really not happening? And you almost, it takes a very strong person, as you obviously are, to get a to recognize, acknowledge, and then decide to act. It's almost like acknowledging, isn't it? How can you acknowledge that it's happening without feeling even worse about yourself for letting it happen? I mean, not let it happen, but you know what I mean? Almost acknowledge.
Well, we have that, yeah, that victim blaming, right? Yes, we blame the victim of, you know, how did she let this happen? How did she not see the red flags? But that's a complete misunderstanding of how the abuse cycle actually works. Mm. So, and this, we'd gone to therapists, this was part of like my super traits and my shame, right? How can I not only help other people fix their marriages, but this happened to me. Like, but I know now that like it was never my fault that I was targeted and misled. Yeah. And then you're like, the abuse only happens once you're trapped.
Yeah.
So that's one of my big things. And you asked earlier, and I realized that I forgot to answer, but if somebody comes to me and they want to have better sex for their partner, that's a red flag for me that I need to screen for coercive control or elements of it. And this is a no shame situation. I rarely see women with super traits that there is not some element of coercive control. And there's just inherently coercive control in most heterosexual relationships and defined gender roles. And then sometimes just being aware of it and calling it out and kind of rebalancing those power dynamics, then it can heal and fix the whole system, because the male might not be aware of their privilege or the advantages that they're taking or what they're doing to their partner. But sometimes, and it's, you know, fairly often, they are fully aware, and then there's kind of a different approach, and safety is a concern when you're leaving those relationships.
It's dangerous
to leave.
It's good that you almost have that filter. You can recognize those things and start that conversation rather than we're not gonna help you enjoy sex so your partner can get more sex.
That's just more control. But that's how, you know, and that's how brainwashed our society has let us be, right? That our pleasure or women's bodies are for our partners and their gratification, and when they want it or he'll leave, and then that speaks to the orgasm gap. And I personally spent a lot of money, and I have so many clients that spent a lot of money on therapy and coaching that didn't recognize coercive control. And even in my early stages of my career, I didn't know what that was. I didn't know how to screen for it. And then, but sometimes even the conversation is just giving my client awareness.
Yes.
And like, she doesn't even need to leave, but she also doesn't need to waste time and money and energy and effort on trying to fix a problem that she has no control over fixing, right?
Mm-hmm. So you've been very generous with your time. Just one final question, if I can sneak it in. So,
yeah, sure.
And I guess it's almost a summary of everything we talked about, really. So there's a woman listening to this today who is feeling stuck between wanting deeper intimacy for herself, and she wants deeper connection, but doesn't know where to start. What would you say to that woman that's listening? Where should they start?
take the super trade quiz for one, because that is so, like, there's so much clarity in just understanding yourself and how you show up in relationships, and where it might not be serving you or serving the relationship, even though you think it's helping. And then little small steps, and this sounds silly, but when your pleasure centers are off, finding what brings you pleasure and brings you joy is so important, to be weaving those things in throughout your day. And your pleasure centers aren't something that you can just, you know, flick a switch and turn on. It's more like a dial that it sort of gradually needs to be shifted. So shifting you out of survival and into receiving. And it can be, you know, going for a walk, having a phone call with a friend that makes you laugh, like just taking a bath, small things, things that feel good, but focusing on those and getting as many of those little things in throughout the day. I guess I do have a sheet of 50 pleasure practices that I, not to confuse people, but that if anyone wanted to download that, that's kind of a where to start.
I know I said it was the last question. I do actually have one more question now. But what one comment first. And I totally agree with the pleasure thing. It's almost, when you think about it rationally, so most of my life is dull and tedious, but I'm going to go all out for pleasure in a bedroom. So what it doesn't sort of go from this to this in one place and back again. And
I know, and we want it to that way. And I wish it was that way, but it's not. Our bodies don't work that way.
I think a lot of, and again, not a diatribe against smartphones, social media, being connected, whatever. But so many people now eat a meal on their phone and their computer or whatever. And you say to the end of the meal, what did you just eat? If you stand, I suppose it's stand over the sink with an incredibly fresh, juicy peach or nectarine and just taste it. It's incredible. Or I can just quickly eat it while I'm on my phone. It's the same thing, but the two things together are so different. Actually, like I think you said before, being present for an amazing book you're reading, a walk in the park, eating a peach, having a glass of wine, whatever, all those things.
Anything for your senses.
All those things just pump up that pleasure center. So when you do want to be intimate, whatever else, you're not coming from a cold start. You're warm already, really. So my final question. It has to be. Well, you've done so much now. You're still very young, but what's next? What are the? Do you know what the next 5 years hold? Are there more books?
I've got another book. There will probably be two in the next 5 years. Yeah, but I'm sort of my sequel of or I guess it's actually like a prequel to The Pink Canary. It's what I've learned since then in the last 6-7 years. I want to continue helping women on the health hormone side of things and the pleasure, and it's like pleasure and power now. It's not just pleasure, because if our pleasure is dependent on those of others, like others' moods and how happy we make others, then it was never really ours to begin with. So to have the power and the sovereignty to protect it. So that's sort of the update of my work in book two that I'm writing. So
does it have a title yet?
No, not yet. It's hard for me. And I've got sort of an autobiographical one as well. That's more my story, but the teaching women how kind of, I feel like, needs to come out first, and my story can come out at whatever point.
Would you promise me you'll come back to talk about the book when it's going to be released?
Yes, I would love to.
Thank you. And just thank you so much for everything you've shared today. There's yeah, there's so much power in what you're saying about pleasure. I think it's for men and women, and I know it's about empowering women and pleasure, but I think if I'm a man and my partner's coming to me and has sovereignty over their own pleasure and knows what they want, whatever, wow, where's the bedroom? Where's the kitchen table?
Yeah, what's next?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And hopefully most men don't feel threatened by that. They feel, yeah, they feel empowered as well.
Yes, and I talk a lot about women, and ironically, in the last like 6 months, I've had a ton of male private clients, but it's that like, how do I show up for this or hold this, or how can I be better? And sometimes I'm just working with them for a day, mm-hmm. and then they're like, okay, got it, good, let's go. where's the bedroom? So yeah, there's so many well-meaning, kind, loving, supportive men out there that want to look at their privilege and how they can show up better. So I want to say that part too.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for your time. I'll let you go and get another coffee now. I really
thank you. Thank you for having me, Andrew.
It's really interesting.